Courtney Brown with the Farsight Institute proposes remote viewing can rewrite human history and the nature of physical reality. Remote viewing is a science and theory of non-physical perception. Perception that's changing for us daily. We're waking up, folks. Stay tuned for part two with Courtney Brown. I'm Robin Clare, and this is Tributaries.
The idea behind subspace is that it's a way to intellectually separate out two realms. That's the physical that you see, and then everything else. Now, it's not a perfect categorization, but it works for the purpose of saying if you don't see it, it's in subspace. And the basic idea is that all things that exist, everything, exists as energy. Remember, E equals mc squared. C squared is the speed of light squared, so that's just a constant. And that's a scaling factor, so E equals m, energy equals mass. And so there is nothing in the universe except energy. When quantum physicists look at anything on the small level, in the micro-quantum level, they see it as what they call wave packets or frequencies that interact together in what they call a state of superposition. So if you get a bunch of waves mixing together, they interact with each other using processes of what they call destructive and constructive interference. But you've all experienced that when you go up to the piano keyboard and you bang on middle C, and then you also bang on B, which is the key right next to middle C. And you hear the frequencies of B and C are interacting and interfering with one another, and that beat frequency produces a warble like wah, 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 wah. And if you hit middle C but then hit the highest B on the keyboard, you won't hear a beat frequency. There actually still is interference between the high frequency and the middle C, but it's nothing to write home about. It's very minor. When frequencies are very close together, that's when they interfere with one another, and they produce these interesting interactions. Well, these interactions result in something called a wave packet, and that is a space where a particle resides. Now, among physicists, they don't know where the particle is, but they know it's in that area that's largely localized in a geographical area, in a local place. So they say the particle is somewhere around here. Now, in the quantum realm, nothing actually happens unless it's registered in some way, as John Wheeler used to say. And that essentially means it needs to be registered or interacted with or observed. Now, people like Einstein used to laugh at this and say, do you really think the moon wouldn't be there if I didn't look at it? But essentially, that's what they're saying. They're saying that everything has to be observed in order to manifest. So what they have said traditionally is that when you look at a wave packet, suddenly all of the possible versions of that particle that exist in that wave packet that's spread over time and space, they disappear, and only one pops out, and everything else disappears. And that one that pops out, that results in something that they used to call, or still do call, the collapse of the wave function. Now, that's the major dispute that's going on in physics right now, whether that collapse eliminates all those other possibilities. Because remember, they didn't know where the particle was, so it was all of those places. And when they look at it, it pops out, and it's only one place. Well, the real question is, did those other potentials actually go away, or are we just looking at one? Is the one that we're looking at a result of our observation? And if we observed differently, would we have found another? Meaning, do the others still exist? We don't see them just because we observed one.
It seems like a funny question to get hung up on if you're at that point already.
Yeah, that is sort of weird. But the traditional interpretation called the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics is still dominant, although there's no real excitement anymore. And it goes back to work by Niels Bohr and Werner Heisenberg. But the real rage now in young people in physics, new professors, is among the so-called other worlds interpretation. And that was developed by Hugh Everett when he was a graduate student, and he published his dissertation in 1957. Working under John Wheeler, who was at Princeton. And Hugh Everett came up with the idea that this quantum wave function actually relates to everything as you aggregate up to larger things, atoms, molecules, people, and buildings, and indeed the whole universe, so that all of these bigger things also have wave functions. When we observe something, we're actually selecting out, not destroying all other versions, but we're selecting out one version, and that's what we see. Now, what the other physicists did, where they were basically saying, no, we are going to allow only one version of us to exist. They had no theoretical reason for assuming that. But they said, we're only going to allow one version of us to exist, and so we don't like this idea that Hugh Everett came up with.
Right. Everett paid
that
the
these
price.
Other worlds, yeah, that these other worlds actually exist. We just don't see them. But it's now really well understood that the frequencies that we don't see are simply out of phase with us, and that's why we don't see them. Physicists got hung up with the idea that mass is real, but they've never found anything solid. Ultimately, everything is just a collection of frequencies. So on the macro level, it looks like we're solid. We have bodies and we live in houses and they look solid. But inside all that stuff, it's just frequencies rolling around.
Yes.
No solid anything.
Yes. You propose remote viewing can rewrite the nature of physical reality. It's stated correctly, I believe, as our interpretation of physical reality. Everett would be happier if he were around
actually,
right now.
Yeah. Fortunately, before he died in the 1970s, he was able to attend one seminar at the University of Texas, where he was the honored guest. Some young professors brought him in. Some older professors were also there. Graduate students were around, and they were spellbound. And he was an absolute chain smoker, so no one else was allowed to smoke in the building, but they didn't care. He went through a few
right.
packs. Just in the couple hours he was there, he went through a few packs of cigarettes, and no one cared because they knew they were dealing with a planetary genius. He had that experience before he died, finally. He left physics originally after his dissertation because he was so widely scoffed at. He just got disgusted with it and went into the Defense Department and started working on nuclear weapon stuff. And he was one of the primary designers of the thing called MAD, which is Mutually Assured Destruction, which is sounding odd, but he actually saved all our butts. You see, back in those days, there were military planners as well as some civilians who were actually literally arguing for a first strike against Russia and China to eliminate them as a threat, thinking that they were going to have to be dealt with at some point in the future anyway, which would have ended up having us being, you know, eventually.
Eight arms and four eyes.
Yeah, we would have been the scourge of the universe. But it was Hugh Everett that said, this will not work. The nuclear fallout and the consequential collateral damage will be of such great extent that it will affect us as equal to everyone else. We're not going to survive it. And so he came up with the idea of saying, let us build our weapons and let them build their weapons, and we'll each point at each other, but nobody will fire, because if anyone fires, we'll all be destroyed. So it was mutually assured destruction. And as crazy as that policy sounds when you think about it, it actually stopped everybody from shooting. And now we have a situation where Russia and China are essentially our allies. And can you imagine how horrific it would have been if that early type of thinking actually persevered? Regardless of your take on Hugh Everett's interpretation of quantum mechanics, you can thank him for saving all of our butts.
I like that story. At the PASS Society for Scientific Exploration conference, I loved when you were talking about the quarter. You just asked everyone in the audience, if the quarter is sitting on your left palm and it's moved to the right palm, is it the same quarter? And you said, of course, no, because it is in a different space and time. And initially it sounds like, oh, a fun little game. But the ramifications of that simple recognition are huge.
Yeah, that's actually true. You see, the quarter that's in one hand at one time has an equation. And this goes back to Hugh Everett's idea of the wave function being generalized to the macro level, to the larger level. And so there is an equation for that quarter. And that equation has pieces of space in it, meaning the location, as well as time in it. T and X, distance, location, is time, are all part of that equation. So when I take that quarter and put it in another hand, its equation is different. The location is different, as well as the time is it. And anything that has a different equation is different. People have to understand that the energy is actually morphed. It's actually transmuted. It's different. It's literally just different. And you can say, well, look, it really is, and it looks the same quarter and so on. But I can say, well, actually it's not. You're just not seeing the changes that occur in the quarter. But imagine yourself when you were a child. You, as a child, had an equation. And then you, as an older person, also have an equation. And you could say, but it's the same person. It's the same me. This is my name. And I say, put a picture of yourself early and late. Look at you. Are you the same? The reality is you just moved yourself through time and space. Your equation changed in time and space. And as a result, you changed and you can see the change. The same is true of the quarter, although the changes, visual changes, are not so easily apparent. But the frequencies, nonetheless, have morphed. That was a very profound type of example to use to let people know that there's nothing but frequencies, and these frequencies interact, and the way they interact have variables for time and space. And so anything that's located elsewhere in time and space, such as a different version of you, simply has different elements in that equation, and that you would not see that alternate version of you because that equation is different. The frequencies would be out of sync. I like that quarter example too. I didn't get that by myself, by the way. I actually heard that example by Bashar, who is an extraterrestrial entity, believe it or not, who's channeled by Daryl Anka, who is the brother of Paul Anka, the pop star. And it was Bashar that actually used that quarter example the first time that I ever heard it. And I loved it for the exact same reasons that you liked it. And so I have put it into my bag of tricks when I go speaking.
And moving along from the quarter, written information is physical content in a way. And now look at how this is being sent all around the world. I can send you a copy of this show over the internet, for instance, and literally in no time at all. And so I'm wondering, are mysteries regarding human teleportation within the science of remote viewing?
Well, actually, this is a very good question, because there is no real dispute in physics that information is the same as energy. Now, we think of information casually as simply stuff that we know, but that's not the way physicists think of it. Ever since the theoretical work of Rolf Landauer and later experimental laboratory demonstrations of this, that information is, in fact, actually energy. And the experiments that were eventually verified recently in the laboratory is when you have information that's in a sealed, isolated system, and you destroy that information, you release heat. So information and energy are different things of themselves, are different versions of the same thing. And E equals MC squared, energy is also the same as mass. It's a different version of the same thing. And so when we're transferring perceptions across time and space, remote viewing the future, bringing that back to the present, taking information from the past by remote viewing the past, bringing that back to the present, we're transferring information, of course, across time and space. But that means we're transferring energy across time and space. Remember, when information is destroyed, heat is released, energy is released. So, and that's been experimentally verified. So the thing that really scares physicists so much is that if this remote viewing stuff is eventually, which it will be, widely understood to be a real phenomenon, all the laws of physics are going to have to be rewritten from ground up, because it really means you are transferring stuff across time and space, which gives you a little bit of an idea of how extraterrestrial craft actually work, meaning you don't see any flying saucers floating around with rockets. They move silently using, and all reports suggest that when they get close to anything of electrical nature, the electrical stuff just zonks out. So whatever they're using for propulsion deals with energy, electromagnetic type of stuff, and that means that they're modifying the energy configuration that is around the ships. And that would actually match with the stuff that we're understanding theoretically of how they would have to move. And that would also explain why the ships are often visible one moment, moving across the sky, and then suddenly they go away. And that includes their radar signature. So they're visible not just visually, but also on radar, and suddenly they go away. And then they pop up again somewhere else in the sky. And you sort of say, well, where were they in between? Well, if you have a technological means of shifting the energy pattern, you could become out of sync with what our minds are selecting out in terms of frequencies, and then they can come back in by simply changing their frequency to pop back into the realm that we're actually seeing. So this remote viewing stuff is unharnessing a huge amount of intellectual potential for us to leap forward in our understanding of the nature of physical reality.
As you develop your non-physical perception, what are some effects that you've experienced in your own life / reality?
I guess this goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the effects on all people who become good at remote viewing. Mind you, in a week-long class, just about everybody can be worked into an experience where they actually do perceive something, so they have that experience of the remote viewing actually working. But you're talking really about what happens when someone becomes really good at it and it becomes a sort of integrated part of their existence, their way of thinking. And in general, there is a, in my particular opinion, there is a understanding of the broader interconnectedness of life, not just with other people, but with physical reality more generally, the planet, the solar system, the galaxy, the universe. And I think that is because of the gradual realization of this overlap in energy between ourselves as wave functions and wave functions of everything else. And when you realize that everything is overlapping with one another, then some of everything else's frequency is part of you. And so literally we are, in a literal sense, physically connected or energy connected, meaning some of the energies that make up you and I are overlapping, and that means some of the energies that make up me are also the same energies that make up you, and thus, in a sense, we're all relatives. With that sense of interconnectedness that becomes more of an intuitive understanding, there is a general appreciation for the peace in the universe. Think of it the opposite. What happens when you are lost in yourself, when you don't recognize any of this interconnectedness? The thing about our physical existence is it emphasizes the idea that we are isolated individuals, because the mind so cleverly selects out only frequencies that it wants. So really, we don't really normally perceive the interconnectedness or the overlap between ourselves and other things. So the nature of our physical existence is that the perceptions are that we're isolated. And when we're isolated, we not only feel that the world is potentially hostile, it is a dangerous place, and we need to defend ourselves against that, and thus we become more polarized in our experience. Everything is one or the other. Two eyes, two arms, friends, enemies, good, bad. And so when that starts to dissolve and you realize the connectedness, you no longer have that constant desire for defense, that constant desire to protect yourself against an outside alien hostile environment. And this sort of new age concept of interconnectedness as all things actually starts to make sense on an intuitive level. And without that, the opposite of that is to look at this new age idea of interconnectedness and to laugh at it and say it's goofy hippie stuff. But once you experience the reality of this interconnectedness, what you originally thought as goofy hippie stuff, because you didn't see how anybody could be connected to anything else, it becomes more sensible to you on a deep level.
Yes, and once it becomes sensible on that deep level, then it becomes more of your outer experience. It's really true what all the mystics have been saying all these years.
Yes, exactly, and it's really hard to fight a war when you're thinking like that. It's really easy to fight a war when you're thinking in a very polarized, isolated way, where you're thinking that the world is out there. It's this level of polarization that led all those planners to actually conceive of the idea of first strikes, nuclear strikes against enemies. Mm-hmm. The idea that the world is hostile and you needed to conquer the enemy, and a nuclear first strike might be the best option to do that. It's that type of thinking that led to that. And you can see how wrong that would have been if it was done back in the Cold War period, when now we are friends with our old perceived enemies, and how horrific would it have been if we destroyed each other out of this sense of paranoia. You almost look back at those times and say, those were essentially people that were mentally ill in some way, but it's not in a schizophrenic sense, but in an isolationist sense. They were so overwhelmed by their sense of isolation and polarization that they didn't see their greater reality, and as a result, they became a threat to themselves and others. And that is the definition, typically, of mental illness. It's not illegal to be crazy, but it is not allowed for someone to be a danger to themselves or others. And the people who were actually considered sane, but actually thinking about nuking the enemies on a first-strike capability to get rid of them before they had to deal with them later, you sort of realize that was a very distorted way of thinking, and they were a danger to themselves and others. You really sort of realize that this sense of interconnectedness that you get with a greater understanding of the remote viewing phenomenon is really healthy. It helps transform that very distorted sense of polarization that is very dangerous because of the idea that you have to defend yourself so much you end up hurting yourself and others. But it also helps to set up the idea that polarized defense against a hostile world can really be abandoned and a greater embrace towards working and cooperating and integrating that world is a much better and healthier option.
Yes, and that just sped right past my next question of, have your spiritual beliefs shifted as a result of your intimate knowledge of remote viewing? Of course, I knew the answer would be yes, but I also like how I can even let go of that spiritual piece, because is it scientific? Is it spiritual? Is it consciousness? It all becomes that one thing. And also, I like how you brought in those words healthy, because the ramifications or implications can also have such a huge difference with healthcare and how we look at the health of someone, and it's wonderful.
Just think of it. In the Cold War days, especially when they were just starting in the 1950s, would it have been healthy in any definition of the term for these otherwise very sane-looking planners to succeed in their argument of a nuclear first strike against Russia and China? It would have killed millions, perhaps billions of people. Talk about the illness that would have resulted as well after that. And any definition of healthy, that would not have been healthy. But they were willing to do that, and they were actually arguing for that. So the idea of health really needs to be generalized to not just obvious mental illness involving schizophrenia, bipolarism, things like that, but it also has to deal with the level of polarization that a normal person experiences. And when that polarization is extreme, you get that person doing extreme things to defend themselves to the point of threatening the health and welfare of other people. And if the person is in a position of authority, where they're arguing for policy implications, such as dropping of nuclear weapons on perceived enemies, then that level of polarization becomes a danger. Now, I have been focusing it on the Cold War, but I could just as easily have focused it on groups that are involved with, say, Islamic terrorism, who thought that bombing of the World Trade Center was a good idea. This idea of attacking your enemies is a result of this extreme sense of polarization, and it's not healthy. People die as a consequence of that.
I read on your website that you are proposing a major demonstration of remote viewing that will rivet the world.
Well, actually, we have demonstrated remote viewing regularly over many years under squeaky clean scientific conditions to the public in ways that were publicly verified. We really mastered the realm of public demonstrations of remote viewing month after month, year after year. The trouble is, tens of thousands of people have watched it when we do these things. But there are 7 billion people on the planet. So even though tens of thousands of people are watching it with absolute perfect public verification of the process, it's a small drop in a very large bucket. So what we have been asking for is for some elements of the mainstream scientific community to publicly acknowledge the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon, so that world attention would be directed in our direction, and we would then be able to, again, conduct public demonstrations of remote viewing, but in which case millions or perhaps billions of people would watch. And that would change the planet in a better direction in a blink of an eye. It would be a huge intellectual manifestation, birth, growth on the planet. And the argument that I have been making recently is that one of our projects, the so-called post-2012 Earth Changes Climate Project, does have indications that in the future, just prior to June 1st, 2013, between now and June 1st, 2013, extensive Earth changes are expected, meaning we've done a project and we're actually waiting to June 1st, 2013 to see if our data are correct. And the details do clearly suggest that there are large Earth changes coming. Now, if these data are correct, and remember it's an experiment, not a deterministic prediction, but if these data are correct, and I think they are, based on the theory I've developed, then this whole dance about denying the existence of remote viewing will be over. Mainstream science would then be irrelevant with respect to whether remote viewing is real or not.
You're going to have to find a job in the public sector, young man.
Well, no. What I really want is for mainstream science to acknowledge the reality of remote viewing before any of these events happen. The reason why is because in the past, in human past, whenever major disruptions or changes have occurred, we have had anarchy. For example, when we had the French Revolution in the late 1700s, you had the Reign of Terror, and that was really only stopped by the rise of Napoleon Bonaparte. Other times there have been chaos. You had the rise of Hitler's, Stalin's, things like that. So if there are major changes coming our way, we run the risk of the masses turning away from not only governmental leadership, but mainstream science, because mainstream science would have been helping the governmental leadership to do whatever tests they're doing to protect themselves. But the masses would say, you know, why should we believe you anymore? And that would open up the possibility of moving into the future in a state of anarchy without the guidance from scientific reason, and that would not be good, because I am a scientist. And I do not want to see that to happen. It's to the benefit of mainstream science to acknowledge the reality of the remote viewing phenomenon prior to what looks like is going to be inevitable recognition among the masses that remote viewing actually works. Because then we can march into the future together, hand in hand, with science guiding an age of reason to produce a better Earth than we have today.
It's a great thing bringing the non-physical into the conversation. Many thanks to Courtney Brown from the Farsight Institute, farsight.org. For guest information, to listen to archives and share resources, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.